I'm told that's how Swami Kriyananda greeted us on this day. January 5th is the day when Yogananda incarnated on this planet. And we celebrated, not because we were born on that day, because he came as a reflection of our own higher self. And in a sense, it is our reawakening or being born again to that higher self. So that's what we'll be celebrating today. The morning will be like any other Sunday, just with a few minor changes. You will follow along as we go. We will now start by hearing Yogananda's voice on the speakers, and then followed by the voice of Rajarshi Janakananda. He was Yogananda's foremost disciple when he had his work in Southern California, and then the voice of Swami Kriyananda.
I see my age is one.
In San Francisco, I remember in the Scottish Rite Auditorium before thousands, I worked up to the problem as to what my age was. And the lowest I got was 25. And the highest I got was 700. And so I asked them, "Do you want to know my age?" And they all said, "Yes," from the whole auditorium. And I said, "I never tell my age." And they just screamed almost, roared. And I said, "You are asking the age of my house. I have no age. My age is one. Infinite. But if you ask a person his age, you don't ask the age of the house. It is not the age of the person. This is the house that I live in. My age is infinite." So it's wonderful to have one candle. Shall I put it out?
If you can, yes.
I
you
think
want
I have.
Help? You want us all to help?
I think still I have a little strength of breath.
Good.
The first birthday, I don't know whose idea it was, but I felt the love behind it and I thought of Master, so much so that I saw Master sitting there instead of myself. He, whose oneness with me has enabled me to help so many, to bring so many bouquets of souls unto the Almighty Omnipresence. I say, make your hearts a hermitage. So many souls that you see, their hearts are hermitage. And I am very proud of you all who are here and who are together with us here. You may think that God is invisible and doesn't talk to you. That isn't true. You keep him away, far away from you. Those who think him to be the nearest of the dear, they find him nearest of the near, dearest of the dear. And those who think him far away, they do not find him at all, for he is far away. You close your eyes and the light is gone, right in front of you. You open your eyes, it's there. So is God's omnipresence. He has purposely hidden. Imagine if he had talked to all, he would be pestered to death. I don't think he would like to exist anywhere because he is everywhere. That's why he remains quiet. And to make him talk, you have to give him the third degree of your heart. Then he will talk. And he does talk. If I didn't know, I wouldn't have told you so. He does talk. And he does answer. It is so touching. He is more than human because he has become all human beings. It is foolishness to say that God is not personal. God is very personal. He has become all of us. And when we see him working through everybody. Sometimes a little child will say something and I'll hear his voice. And it is true. Behold him through every niche of space. On every altar of your thought, and he shall behold you. He who watcheth me everywhere, I watch him always. He never loses sight of me, nor I lose sight of him. That's what Bhagavad Gita says.
Now we'll hear the voice of Rajarshi, who is Yogananda's successor and foremost disciple.
We all, of course, would like to have Master here today, but in the absence of his physical presence, we do feel fortunate to have heard his words and to have felt his presence, because he is with us in spirit. And if you will tune in with him, you will find that you feel that presence. You must feel that presence if you are to realize your oneness with Christ.
And now we have an audio clip of Swami Kriyananda speaking on Master's birthday.
This is the birthday of that great Master whose life has inspired us and brought us to this path. I met him more than 41 years ago, in 1948, in Los Angeles. It was an earth-shaking experience for me. I had never really expected anything like it. I was not against the idea of guru. I didn't even know such an idea existed. I didn't know anything about yoga. It sounded like a sort of a funny word to me. I wasn't quite sure what it meant, but it didn't seem to have a serious ring to it, sort of like the yolk of an egg or yogurt. Or And I didn't know anything about meditation or all these things, except that I had read a book that fanned my desire intensely, because I had reached the point in my own inner growth of feeling that God had to be something that we could attune ourselves to more deeply, that he had to be some consciousness that we could live so close to that our lives would be uplifted by it. And it couldn't be just a belief system. It had to be an experience, or it wasn't worth anything. And so in desperation, I was looking for something that would help me to understand how this was possible. But I didn't know about saints. I knew that certain people had been called saints, but I didn't know what it meant. And so I tried to meditate, and I would sit on my bed and sort of try to stop my body from fidgeting around, and I didn't know how to go at it. And I thought, well, what am I to do? How am I to do it? And then I came upon Autobiography of a Yogi. And when I read that book, the experience, I'm sure, is one that you've all shared. Because in reading that book, I suddenly realized that this thing is real. It's been brought down out of ancient times into modern life. It's been brought down out of some distant culture into what I'm living right now. It's something I can do. And it's something so wonderful that I've always in my heart felt that it had to be true. And yet, how? Suddenly this one book and this one person made it all possible to me and all real to me. And when I read things like, I mean, it was, perhaps for you it's been easier because after all you've grown up exposed to words like yoga and reincarnation and karma. And I imagine you can find the word karma even in our English dictionary now. But in those days it just wasn't heard. And so when I came upon, I think it's page 8, Lahiri Mahashai, materializing in a wheat field, and saying, Bhagavati, you are too hard on your employee. You'd think that I would just say no. But I couldn't. There was something so compelling, so sweet, so full of real feeling, real humility, real devotion, that I felt, well, I can't accept it, but I can't reject it. And I came to things like Babaji living hundreds of years, and I just had to say, well, it's beyond my experience. But whatever this man says, I have to accept. He couldn't possibly be insincere. So I had to put those things on a shelf. I couldn't accept them, I certainly couldn't reject them, but I completely accepted him.
Shri.
Meditate together now for a few minutes, feeling that Yogananda is meditating with you, right beside you, filling your body cavity with his presence, sitting at the point between the eyebrows. Picture the great master meditating with you and for you.
Love and joy enfold me in me.
And the new path, Swami Kriyananda recalls an instance that he had with Yogananda. You know, this was in the initial months when he had started living in Mount Washington with Master. When I say Master, I'm referring to Yogananda. When Yogananda was speaking, when we heard just a few minutes ago, he was referring to his guru, Sri Yukteswar, when he said Master. So Swami Kriyananda was living with Yogananda, and his parents were out of the country. As he describes it, he read the autobiography of a yogi, and he immediately took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles, and he came to meet Yogananda. And his parents were in Egypt at that time. They had left the country. And he had a couple of relatives in the Los Angeles area, Sue and Bud Clavel. And they came to check on Swami, and they came to Hollywood Church to attend a service given by Master, and they had lunch afterwards with Swami and Dr. Lewis and Master and a few others. And Swami writes about this incident in the New Path, and he says Master was such a gracious host, and Sue and Bud were really impressed with how kind he was, how welcoming he was. And clearly, they really liked him as a person. And then he describes a short exchange that he had with Sue after the lunch, where Sue says, "Everything's great, I'm happy you found your teacher and everything's working out for you, but why do you have to call him Master? You know, none of us are slaves here. You know, it's a free country, why do you have to call somebody that?" And Swami gives a lot of explanations. There's a few exchanges that he has back and forth with Sue. And he says, you know, he's not a master in the sense that he's taking decisions for me or that I've given away my free choice. He's master in the sense that he's the master of everything that I'm trying to achieve, what I'm looking for in my life. And they go back and forth, and somehow the conversation ends with just the both of them agreeing to disagree. and, you know, knowing how kind Swami was, I'm tempted to assume that perhaps that exchange was even more polarized than what he presented in the New Path. But as I was reading it yesterday, I was thinking, you know, whether it's 1949 or 2020, the questions don't change. They're fairly the same. Why do you have to call somebody a master? You know, we are all free. We think for ourselves. Why do you have to be obedient to somebody else? And when we move through the world just with our rational intellect, just the way we take decisions, and, you know, when we price our common sense in the sense that all that we perceive as reality is what we understand through our senses and what our logical brain can perceive, then it is a hard sell to think of somebody as a master. You know, to think of pledging or to think of following somebody, to think of being obedient to somebody else's guidance. But somewhere along the line, all of us have had this experience. You know, there's this tiny inkling of the intuition of the heart that helps us see something that we otherwise are not capable of seeing. We somehow are able to perceive something that we don't fully understand with our rational intellect. You know, I see the picture of Yogananda and I want to read this book, I'm immediately drawn to it. I hear this music and I'm touched in my heart and I really want to take this in. I'm yearning for more of this. And then we start to realize that, you know, there is more to this world than we can see. That there are great saints. You know, there are these great souls that live amongst us. And somehow the key to our own happiness lies in things that these souls have already discovered and what they've come to share. And not only great saints, and there are, you know, incarnations of people who are so completely free, who are sent by God to guide us, to help us. And that, when we recognize that light which has come to help us, then it's not something we are thinking about. It is the most natural instinct of the human heart to adore, to respect, to honor, to look for that guidance, to attune to that consciousness. And then it starts making sense to us why we would call somebody a master. Why we would look up to somebody in that way of trying to attune to their consciousness, helping us find our own way in our life. You know, I think of myself as somebody of fairly intellectual persuasion, or at least I used to be. You know, the word I think of is mental. I read the autobiography, I think, 11 years ago. I was trying to calculate yesterday. And I was deeply, deeply touched by that book. I would say that was perhaps the most significant time in my life where I had that experience. And you know, about 9 or 10 years ago, I moved to the US. I did not come to California. I first came to the Midwest. I came to grad school, and I was there for a year before I moved here. And even by then, I was so drawn to that book and so deeply touched by that experience of reading the autobiography that I was completely convinced that Yogananda was my guru. I wanted to meditate. You know, I had a fairly regular meditation practice. I was meditating every day. I was rather proud of it, and which is an indication that I needed a correction. And so everything was going well for me. But I have to say, I never had more than a 5-minute conversation with anybody, any devotee, anybody who was following Yogananda's teachings. I was just doing all this by myself. And I came to the US, and somehow life took some sharp turns. I was in grad school. It was just a new country. I was trying to do a lot of credits to do my coursework and graduate soon. And I had to also, I had a 15-hour job. It was just overwhelming. And well, I can only say that my meditation practice was very far from what I would consider as being ideal. And there are only 2 spiritual things I brought from India in my bags, and one of them was a picture of Master that you call Last Smile. Actually, this is the picture. I framed it some time back, and I wanted to put it on the altar because I was decorating the altar yesterday. And you know, I set up my room, I got an apartment, you know, I was living with some friends, and right next to my bed, I had this picture. I put it on the wall, I used scotch tape and everything, and I set up my altar, and I had 2 pictures. One was a picture of Master, and another smaller picture of Babaji. And, you know, I was trying to keep up my meditation practice, but obviously, as I was saying, it was not going as well as I wanted it to. But I do recall occasionally, you know, when I had, you know, perhaps when I had 8 hours of sleep, or, you know, when I was just calmer and more centered, I would just open my eyes after a half an hour or 40 minutes of meditation. I would look at that picture, and I would think this passing thought in my head, you know, this picture is so beautiful. You know, how could this be so beautiful? These eyes, this face. What is it that's so radiant with this picture? And, you know, it was a passing thought, and I would just go about my business for the rest of the day. And all those other times, you know, when I was struggling, you know, sitting there for 10 minutes with a completely restless and preoccupied mind, you know, God knows what I'm doing here. You know, am I meditating? Am I not? Hong saw, hong saw. You know, just trying to make it work. And just opening my eyes and thinking, what am I doing here? You know, is this even working? Does this work? Is this supposed to work? You know, why do I have this picture in front of me here? You know, who is this guy? You know, I just read a book. And then why am I doing what I'm doing? I had no context for any of this, honestly, at that point. I didn't, like I said, I didn't know anybody who was a devotee or a disciple, or I hadn't figured out most things in my life. And, you know, it took a few rounds of this repeating for me to realize, well, nothing's changing with the picture. You know, it's just where it is, and it's just the way it is. Perhaps something is changing in me. Perhaps my consciousness is going up and down, and I see the world differently based on how I'm doing inside. I'm reflecting on the world, my own inner reality. And perhaps there's something wrong with me when I don't see what's right in this picture, because I do recall, I do remember, I was aware enough to know that any time I was centered, when I was calm and I was peaceful, when I was in an uplifted state of consciousness, I was seeing the beauty in that picture. And any time I was not, it was just, you know, a thing in front of me. Then it did not have any of that power that I was perceiving before. You know, it was a wake-up call for me. And, you know, I thank God, you know, even when I was not having a great meditation, I was praying, you know, just, what should I do here? What, you know, please help me. And then I realized what my prayer should be. It should simply be that I don't want to lose sight of the beauty in this picture. Because as long as I can see that, as long as I can stay in tune with that, I know I'll have a conscious way of choosing that calmness, of that state of consciousness where I'm uplifted. you know, some time ago I was browsing through a book, this, you know, I just found somewhere. And this was a book written by some very academic person. And this was almost a thesis on various teachers who came to the U.S. and, you know, the work they did and all the different religions in the U.S. and stuff like that. And some, for some reason, there was a section about master in that book. Because this author, this lady, was also talking about various Hindu teachers who started coming to the West in the 20s and the 30s and just that era of emerging spirituality in this country. And there was just a lot she was saying, which, you know, I was just bored and I was just browsing through it because it didn't make much sense to me. It was very academic and this person was really not relating to it from any place of personal experience. But there was one sentence in there that really caught my attention. She wrote, you know, because Yogananda was primarily devotional in nature, he did not stress upon the use of Sanskrit language. And, you know, it seems like a very valid thought. I thought to myself, yeah, I was aware of both those, you know, facts that Yogananda was very devotional in nature and he did not stress upon the use of Hindu rituals or images or Sanskrit mantras or things like that. But I had never put them together in that same way, although it makes logical sense. You know, you don't want to presume why somebody like Yogananda, somebody who's self-realized, does anything. But still I could see that there was a validity to what she was saying. But then as I thought about that sentence and I was just sitting with it, I realized there's so much more to this first part of the sentence. Because Yogananda was devotional in nature, you know, so much follows from there. Yes, he did not stress upon the use of Sanskrit language because it didn't matter. He was coming to the US in 1920. He was coming to reawaken a new understanding of Christianity, of the teachings of the Christ. He was coming to bring the sacred techniques of Kriya Yoga. It didn't matter whether people knew Sanskrit language or Sanskrit mantras. But so much else also follows from there. Because Yogananda was primarily devotional in nature, he taught us that our own spirituality is not bound by social or cultural constraints. It does not depend on any of the externals. Excuse me. Because Yogananda was primarily devotional in nature, we know that my spirituality is not defined by what I call my official religion. It is not defined by, you know, where I grew up. It is not defined by what rituals I do, what practices I do. It is not even dependent on the techniques or anything we consider as you know, a practice. Even those techniques and all the meditation practices that we, you know, that we follow with a lot of discipline that Yogananda taught us are only, they're useful in only as much as they take us closer in our own understanding of that divine reality and how much we're able to open our heart. Because Yogananda was devotional in nature, we know that my spirituality is simply that. It is my connection with the divine and how much I am able to open my heart in that connection. And that's really what Yogananda came to do. Because there's so much, I was paying attention more than before when Swami was speaking that recording. I had cut that MP3 piece, but I had not listened to it that well. You know, he says, how can one book, that one book fanned my desire. You know, I just love that word. It fanned my desire. That's really what Yogananda came to do. I remember reading that book for the very first time. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't explain what I was feeling. You know, I was crying profusely. I didn't even know why. And I remember all those patches of time when I went through, when I was confused, when I was not sure whether, you know, this is working out. What should I do? Am I a disciple of Yogananda? Should I be practicing Kriya Yoga? I could go back to that place of feeling that vibration, touching that for the very first time through that book, because I know it fanned my desire. It fanned my desire for something deeper, something greater, something that this world is not possible. It just is not capable of giving me. And that's really what he came to do. You know, there's a lot of accomplishments. You know, Swami, in his biography of Yogananda, he describes all the reasons why Yogananda came to this world, you know, to bring about a new interpretation of the scriptures. You know, his interpretation of the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, he brought about a whole revolution of in how we think about these teachings. You know, he came to, he came for so much more. He came to teach what renunciation was. He came to revive the, you know, the arts and how we open our hearts to the divine through creative expression. You know, there was a lot that he brought. He came to bring the sacred teachings of Kriya Yoga. You know, he came to teach us that religion has to be grounded on inner communion, not based on outward ritual. But more than all of this, more than all of this, Yogananda came to show us, to fan that desire, to show us that it is possible for us to develop that deep personal connection with the divine. And everything else in this world, all the roles that we play in this life, is after all an illusion. It's a setting so that we can learn our lessons, so that we can ultimately deepen that love for the divine and share that love with everybody around us. A lot of us have experiences. Yogananda was not just a teacher. He was so much more than that. He was not just somebody who was teaching us how to love God, but he was also the perfected example of all that it meant to live in that state of consciousness. And the way we'll practice his teachings, the way we tune into his consciousness, is not through the rational intellect, but by attuning to his vibration. All of us, a lot of us, I would say, you know, we have had experiences. Every so often, I can certainly speak for myself, you know, just things that, you know, I think the best word to describe it is synchronous, where, you know, there's a response to that prayer, there's a calling from the heart, and there's a response from the divine. And I think of all those instances in my own life where, over the last many years, through that experience of the divine, through instances in my own life, I've come to learn, to come to realize, to strengthen my own faith in what I'm practicing. And what Yogananda taught us is that power of the heart, to be able to draw the divine closer to us, you know, to be able to work on our own salvation, which is simply deepening our connection with the divine, to love God more deeply. Swami Kriyananda, in conversations with Yogananda, he recalls an incident where this man came to Master with a lot of intellectual questions. He was just burning with so much doubts and so many questions that he wanted to ask Master. And this is a very unusual exchange that Swamiji describes, where this man would ask a question and Yogananda would simply say, "Love God." And then as he kept asking more and more questions, Yogananda would just say, "Love God," and his voice got louder and louder as this person kept asking more questions. Thankfully, you know, we are not working directly with a teacher who can only give us so much. We had Swami Kriyananda, who was able to clarify and explain what Yogananda brought. But that's really what Yogananda could give that person. And in a sense, that's really what he was giving in essence to all of us. He was giving to all of us that key that we hold in our own hearts to be able to draw that divine closer to us. All these experiences, anything that you have felt in your own life, anytime you feel the presence of the divine, it is possible, it happens only because there is a call in our own heart through which we draw the divine closer to us. We hold that power in our heart. And Yogananda came to fan that desire. You know, Swami, you know, thinking of what Swami was just saying a few minutes ago, one man, one book, how could I change so much? You know, I couldn't accept any of those things that he was saying. You know, Larry Mahashai materializing in the wheat field, Babaji living for hundreds of years in the Himalayas, and yet I had completely accepted him. And he says, because I could feel such real devotion in those pages. You just know that this man cannot be insincere. You know, I came across this article in the LA Times from 1925, which I shared in an email I sent out. And I was reading that article. This was a reporter who perhaps had nothing to do or no particular interest in Eastern philosophy or everything that was happening at that time in Los Angeles, you know, that whole scene of New Age spirituality. But then You know, he writes, I'm not sure if I quoted the sentence in my letter, I'm perhaps paraphrasing a little bit, but he almost says these exact words. He says, what the Swami did not have in terms of, command over language or the pomp or, you know, that ability to, command a stage, he had, he made up for it in his sincerity. And I thought about it, and that's really what Yogananda, that was the power he himself had. Because that sincerity and the devotion that he was able to bring through his vibration, that touched so many people. You know, nowadays we talk about, when we recall Yogananda's life and we read literature from the past, you know, you talk about Yogananda having all these demonstrations of miracles on stage, of how, you know, thousands of people would attend his talks and so many people, you know, he would perform feats that, about holding his heartbeat or, displays of strength that seemed far from human. And certainly he did all that, but I think for the historians, if you were to go back and think or look at it, you would see that during that time in the US in 1920s and the 30s, it was not uncommon. There were so many teachers. There were so many, I could quote names from whatever I've read, but it doesn't even matter because none of us were alive during that time and we probably wouldn't recognize or know. But, you know, evangelism and, you know, that kind of preaching and speaking to tens of thousands of people was just a thing that happened during those times. Yogananda entered the scene and he was tuning into what was happening and doing whatever it was that he needed to do to awaken people. But, you know, it was not uncommon during those days. There were so many of these teachers who were commanding their audience, who had tens of thousands of people. I read about, you know, Christian preachers and others who would hold these large meetings during those times. And, you know, just being able to have that kind of power, and people were receptive. The West Coast and Los Angeles, especially during that time, as historians talk about it, people were very, very receptive to these type of things there. But I'm not sure how many birthdays we celebrate. Now, you know, 100 years since Yogananda came to the US, how many of those teachers can claim to have touched millions of lives? It's not just about one best-selling book. It's not about the number of copies that Autobiography of a Yogi has sold. You know, you can look around and you can think of how much, you know, even to think about the fact that words like yoga and meditation, all of these teachings, how alien these were, and to think about how much these are part of popular culture now. And Yogananda was the very first of those teachers to take residence in the US. And what he was accomplishing was so much more in terms of vibrations he was planting than, you know, whether writing this one book or, you know, giving this one talk. It were the seeds that he was planting in the ether that were going to sprout in the future. You know, he spoke about, again, I think about all those letters and talks of Master where he talks about India and America and, you know, the coming together of the East and the West. And I think about how, until 1947, India was not even independent. You know, Yogananda, I mean, it was clear that India was going in that direction, so it was not a surprise. But so many things that are so self-evident to us right now, they were not in those days. India was just an extremely poor and undeveloped country that was, you know, being colonized by the English. To say that India is going to be leading this world spiritually, you know, I don't know how people were reading it when Yogananda was speaking. He was obviously an Indian teacher, and, you know, all his followers were completely drawn to these teachings, so perhaps they were not surprised. But to make proclamations like that in 1935 and 1940, and, you know, even before India was independent, you understand that this man was standing there with a complete vision for what the world was going to see. He was coming as a harbinger of a new age, of an age where he was not only predicting and seeing this unity, but he was the one bringing that unity. And his presence, his coming to the US, was not just a mission for one organization or one set of disciples or one group or other, but simply for this entire planet, for a new age of how people are going to perceive spirituality, how people were going to define their own personal practice and relationship with God. And he came and he was coming. His mission was to reawaken and bring all of that, to set that in motion. Because not all of this happened during his lifetime. You know, Yogananda passed away, you know, 60, 70 years ago. And during his lifetime, so many things that he started never saw fulfillment. You know, Swami Kriyananda in his life himself fulfilled a lot of those prophecies that Yogananda planted the seeds for. But when Yogananda was speaking, when Yogananda was teaching, what he was doing in this country, what he was doing on this planet, was so much more than what people were able to see at that time. And I think what we even understand right now, because somebody of that stature, somebody with that kind of power, a perfected example of that complete infinite consciousness does not descend with a small purpose. And that's really what Yogananda came for. But, you know, we cannot forget that it doesn't matter how cosmic or planetary his purpose is. Ultimately, all that it came down to is that one sentence that Swami said. He came to fan the desire of our own human heart. And that's really what has brought all of us together. So let's honor and attune to that infinite consciousness on this wonderful day. We'll have an offering ceremony at the end of service where we'll invite all of you to to the altar to place rose petals on the pictures of Yogananda. And not just today, but every day of our lives, the more we can tune in, the more we can see the beauty in that picture, the more we ourselves are drawn to that consciousness and, you know, find ultimate fulfillment. God bless you. I'm going to be sharing a song right now with all of you. This is originally a piece that those who are trained in classical music might know. It's called Liebeslied. It's a piece that's played on the violin. It was composed for it. And Yogananda rewrote the words for this song. And he called it Divine Love Sorrows. That's what we'll share now.
Steal the flowers of my heart.
Raise your hands and feel the power of God's love flowing through you as we send that love out to truth seekers everywhere.
Time has come for us to see that there's but one reality upon the earth and high above, the truth that all was made from love. A love that calls to us to fly above the hills, above the sky, above the storms, above the pain, a land where peace and laughter reign. Oh, Master, may thy joy fill our days. Oh, Master, may thy wisdom guide our way. Guide all our hopes and all our dreams, past every glow that only seems, into the light, the inner sun, into the truth that we're all one. Help us to find in every hour, in every thought, in every flower, the joy that spans eternity, the truth that makes us ever free. Oh, Master, may thy joy fill our days. Oh, Master, may thy wisdom guide our way.